From the Sky News Centre at 5, police in Dallas said they had no other option but to use a bomb robot to kill a suspect who'd been exchanging fire with officers. Three other people are being held after five officers were killed and at least seven injured by snipers. Well, before he was killed, the cornered suspect said he was angry about black people being killed by white officers. Dallas Chief of Police David O'Brown says all communities should now come together.
There are no words to describe the atrocity that occurred to our city. All I know is that this must stop, this divisiveness between our police and our citizens.
A paranoid schizophrenic who repeatedly stabbed a pensioner after a minor road accident has been given a life sentence with a minimum of 10 years. Matthew Daly was convicted of the manslaughter of Donald Locke, who he knifed 39 times on the A24 in West Sussex last July. Female soldiers will soon be allowed to fight on the front line in close combat roles. The Prime Minister has accepted a recommendation from the head of the army to allow them to join tank and infantry units. Two teenagers have died at Scotland's biggest music festival, Tea in the Park. Police say they're treating the deaths of a man and a woman at Strathallan Castle in Perthshire as unexplained. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on. You can count on.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Labour peer Lord Stoddart of Swindon. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Iraq war criminals, also the murderers of MOD weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly. A massive blast also in Baghdad kills over 250 innocent people, and Dallas snipers, whoever they are, kill five police officers and injure six more in an otherwise peaceful Black People Matter rally. Plus, we have an exclusive interview with one of the most important intelligence insiders in the run-up to the illegal invasion of Iraq, Susan Lindauer. She suffered a year in jail to keep her out of the way and was threatened with being drugged into and being a permanent zombie just for telling the truth about what Colin Powell really knew. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and some showers. This weekend, highs of 22, mainly cloudy on Saturday, sunshine and showers on Sunday, but breezy throughout the weekend. Next week, highs of 18, sunshine, showers and windier at the beginning of the week, sunnier towards the end of the week. Next weekend, 16th and 17th of July, highs of 21 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour peer Lord Stoddart of Swindon. Hi, Lord Stoddart, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Yes, how do you do?
Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, Lord Stoddart of Swindon? Do you actually live in Swindon?
No, I live in Reading, as a matter of fact. But I represented Swindon in the House of Commons, of course, between 1970 and 1983.
Can you tell us a little bit about the normal transition from being an MP in the House of Commons to the House of Lords? How did you become a Lord?
Well, I became a Lord when I was knocked out of the House of Commons. And the reason I'm there, I believe, is that Michael Foot, because of the great defeat that Labour suffered in 1983, saw the House of Lords as a long stop to the Thatcher government. And since I was a former whip, he wanted administrative people there and people who knew how to run things. So I was one of the whips, the ex-whips, who was sent to the House of Lords to manage it a bit better, let me put it that way, to make it more effective.
Now, no disrespect to you, but many people would say, well, you know, Michael Foot and the Labour Party were roundly defeated back in those days, so why should someone like you still be in politics?
Well, I think I've just explained that to you. I was sent there because I had experience in politics, and after all, the House of Lords is our only second chamber. It was not very effective. Michael Foot thought that in the interests of decent opposition, the House of Lords should be used to look at legislation from the House of Commons more closely than it had done previously. I think that's very good.
A lot of people say that because it's unelected, really, the House of Lords should go.
Well, that's a very laudable ambition. And if it overdoes itself, I believe that it should be abolished. Unfortunately, in the Blair era, the House of Lords, by the expulsion of the hereditaries, was made more powerful, and it's seized that power to be more effective and to defeat sometimes unreasonably legislation that's come from the House of Commons.
Well, you may say unreasonable, but that legislation has been drawn up by people who we've elected.
No, I said the House of Lords unreasonably. You misunderstand what I've said. Overturned legislation that had come from the Commons and been agreed by them.
Okay, what about, I mean, I've got a feeling of a bit of omerta going on here, maybe it's just with this programme, because nobody from the local Labour Party, the senior people, I approach Bristol's three Labour MPs for Bristol East, that's Kerry McCarthy, Bristol West, Thangam Debonair and Karen Smith, and Bristol South, at the beginning of this week, plus, in the middle of the week, plus all six senior Labour cabinet members, except Paul Smith, who was on this programme just a couple of weeks ago, but none of them could put in an appearance this week. We're really desperate to find out what's going on in the Labour Party, because there seems to be a bit of a national crisis at the moment, what with the post-Brexit, Lord Stoddart, vacuums of leadership in the Tory party and at UKIP too.
Yes, but let me explain. I'm not a member of the Labour Party. I'm independent Labour. You do understand that. So that I can't really tell you what's going on in the Labour Party except for hearsay.
Okay, well, even with that hearsay, what's your view of what's happening as an ex-Labour MP?
Well, my view is quite clear, that the Labour Party outside the House of Commons gave Jeremy Corbyn a great mandate. Over 60% of the votes were cast for Jeremy Corbyn. And I think it would be unreasonable and unacceptable if the Parliamentary Labour Party were in fact to force an election and try to force Corbyn out. He's been properly elected by the Labour electorate, by the great mass of the Labour Party, and that should be respected by the Parliamentary Labour Party.
Well, just because Kerry McCarthy couldn't make it in here today doesn't mean to say we can't hear from her, because she did appear on the Sunday Politics last weekend on the BBC, and she believes, let's have a listen to her now, she believes Jeremy Corbyn is unelectable.
I was very disappointed with Jeremy's lack of leadership during the referendum campaign. I was even more disappointed with his response at the Shadow Cabinet the day afterwards. I didn't think he appreciated the state the country was in. I don't think he had any answers, any strategic vision. But when it comes down to it, the most loyal thing you can do to the Labour Party is to make sure that we are an electable alternative to the current government. But I just don't think he is. I mean, we tried to make it work for 9 or 10 months. Those of us, I mean, quite a few people wouldn't try to make it work, and they chose to be on the back benches. Those of us in the Shadow Cabinet did try to make it work. We tried to work with him and his office. But we just got to the point where we didn't have that faith in him to do it. I think, you know, if press reports are correct, he went to bed at 11 o'clock the night of the referendum and couldn't be got hold of the next morning for a quote because he hadn't caught up with what was happening yet. I mean, that to me sort of signals his sort of... My nephew sent me a text after... Little nephew sent me a text after the England-Iceland game, and he said they didn't want to put the shirt on. And I think that was probably... You could have said that about Jeremy in the EU referendum campaign. And for someone seeking to be Prime Minister, you know, there's a huge responsibility that comes with that. And it's not something where you can sort of be propped up by other people around you and just be a sort of cult-type figurehead.
A cult-type figurehead, Martin, and what Kerry's saying there is Jeremy just didn't put the shirt on during the referendum campaign.
Well, I think that's rather odd, isn't it? Because in actual fact, if you look at one of the most stunning things about the referendum campaign to me was the fact that the majority of people in South Wales voted for Brexit. And that, of course, is... Yeah, well, I mean, I'm personally a Remain voter, sir. But on the other hand, I think Jeremy Corbyn's position was in line with the sentiment in the country, which was unenthusiastic about the EU as currently constituted, but recognising it as the lesser of two evils in the circumstances. Well, and I think that was the best line he could have taken in the circumstances.
He did his duty as the leader of the Labour Party. It's a great pity that the people in the Parliamentary Labour Party don't, in fact, understand democracy. Democracy is when you ask a body of people who they want as leader, and when they give the answer by 60% of the vote, that is something which should be respected. And instead of attacking their leader, they should be supporting him, helping him, because he needs help. He's new to it. He's been a backbencher for 35 years, so that he needed support and assistance and not criticism. And after all, he was offering the country something new. And I believe the country wants something new. And they are entitled, in actual fact, to be able to choose between the parties and not, in fact, vote for what is virtually a one-party state.
But, Lord Stoddart, people also have to act on their conscience, like things like the Iraq war vote and things like that. And for Kerry McCarthy, she's saying clearly she doesn't believe Corbyn is electable.
Well, I don't know how old she is, how much experience she's had in the Labour Party. I was in the Labour Party for 54 years. And I always remember Harold Wilson, great chap. I liked him very much. And one of the most famous things he said was a week is a long time in politics. There is 4 years to go before the next general election. And what the Labour Party in the House of Commons should be doing is to support their leader, help their leader, and understand that he is trying to offer the country choice, and they should help to be making what that choice will be in 4 years' time.
Well, another thing that Kerry McCarthy said was that she didn't really believe that Jeremy Corbyn's heart was in it.
I would hope that Jeremy... I don't think his heart's in it. I don't think he really wants to stay in place, but you know, I've not had any contact with him since I resigned, so yeah, that's just a supposition on my part. But I still think the best thing would be for him to stand aside and let Tom Watson take over as a caretaker leader and then eventually have a contest. But I think the people surrounding him aren't acting in his best interest by trying to force him to stay on.
Are you getting a lot of stick from the party membership?
In terms of... I'm getting a mixed response. There's certainly been a lot of abuse on social media, although I don't think they're all genuine Labour Party supporters. They're people who may have come on board in the last year. In terms of, I was with a bunch of councillors, activists, the former MP, Roger Berry, at a party he had yesterday, and they've all been good and supportive and sensible about it.
Kerry, can I ask you a question? Why in this turmoil are the unions supporting a man who is clearly unelectable in this country?
I don't know.
Well, that was a Conservative MP chipping in at the end there. But Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, I think the idea that his heart's not in it is a psychological warfare tactic almost. It's like Assad must go. He's got to go. He's on the way out. He knows he's got to go. I think Jeremy Corbyn's position is pretty clear. He said he's not going to go. And the reason he's not going to go is because, as Lord Stoddart pointed out, he's got a smashing mandate from this time last year. If he was to go because he was being bullied by Labour MPs, the activists would rightly be furious with him. And of course, he's actually a humble chap who's only he's taken up the role because other people wanted him to do it. And that's why he's going to stick to his guns.
Lord Stoddart, what Kerry's saying there is, and she is a Labour insider, that his heart's not in it. It's not in the job.
Well, how does she know that? Jeremy Corbyn has been loyal to the Labour Party over a very long period of time, and he has enunciated his policies. He has been elected on those policies, and now that he's been elected the leader, it is the duty of the Parliamentary Labour Party to support him. And those who have resigned haven't learned the first lesson of politics. That is, never resign. If they really believe in their policies as opposed to his policies, they should be in there fighting for them instead of being outside the Labour Party trying to undo the voice of the people who elected Jeremy Corbyn by a huge majority. These people depend on the activists outside to get their seats, and they really ought to remember that they owe everything they've got to the Labour Party, who selected them, who supported them, and whose members got them elected by their hard work and donations to the funds.
Have you ever really upset the Labour Party leadership over the years? Because I'm wondering if maybe that's why you're an independent Labour peer yourself, Lord Stoddart.
The reason I'm a Labour independent Labour is because I was expelled from the Labour Party after 54 years being a member of it. And the reason I was expelled was because I objected very strongly to the imposition of Tory defectors to save seats in the Labour Party. And when Sean Woodward, of all people, was imposed on St. Helens South, I took so much grave exception that when one of the defeated Labour people, who'd been in the party for a very long time and done a great deal of work, decided to oppose Sean Woodward, I sent him a letter of support and 50 quid, and I'm glad I did it. And if that's if for backing Labour people instead of defecting Tories, if that's the reason they wanted me out of the party, well, that's up to them.
I wonder what you make of the choice of the Parliamentary Conservative Party over their leadership election, Lord Stoddart, because they've chosen either Theresa May or Andrea Leadsom. What do you make of these two candidates?
Well, frankly, that's nothing to do with me. I'm sure they're both able people, but I don't know them very well, quite frankly. If I may say so, I think that the Prime Minister should not have resigned. He accused people like me of being a quitter, and all those who voted for Brexit to be quitters, and the first person to quit is the Prime Minister. And he should have stayed there to make sure that the wishes of the people were carried out by going straight away or as soon as possible for the Article 50 and starting the negotiations to leave. But instead of that, he quit his post. I think both women, if I may say so, are extremely able and I believe would lead the country well from a Conservative point of view. But of course, I'm independent Labour and I have nothing to do with that election.
Martin, what do you make of the Conservative leadership? Because it's going to be a few months before the party members, the Tory party members, get to choose that out of those two people. The Parliamentary Conservative Party have already
chosen two candidates for them. What do you make of the choice that they've presented now for the party members?
Well, I think there are two major issues that they're going to have to confront. One is, are we going to remain in the single market or not? And I think the other members of the European community have made it clear that if we want to stay in the single market, we'll have to accept free movement of labour, which, of course, is one of the main issues of the Brexit campaign. The other is, which is rather suppressed in mainstream discourse, is what's going to happen with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which I understand Tory right-wingers, apart from Peter Lilly, are in favour of, even though they're also in favour of leaving the European Union. So we're then getting into a bizarre situation where we're going to leave the European Union, but we're going to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is a deal between the European Union and the United States, which will override British national law. It may be that Brexit will lead to the scuppering of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and to my mind that would be no bad thing. But I don't think the Conservative Party as a whole has even thought about this at all.
What about either of you, really? Have you got any thoughts about Theresa May? Because she didn't nail her colours to the mast in the referendum campaign. And one does wonder if that's if she was doing that deliberately, sort of playing both sides in the campaign. Maybe you first, Lord Stoddart.
Well, I really don't know what her motives were. Obviously, one would prefer somebody who'd been on the Brexit side. But she has said that she will carry out the wishes of the people and will form a team which is in favour. At least I think this is what she said or intimated, would be in favour and have been in favour of Britain leaving the European Union. So that's my view, which, of course, comes from outside the Tory party.
Okay, what about this idea of waiting for quite a while, maybe several months before triggering Article 50? Because I noticed that you, I'm looking online, I see that you've suggested that it might even be simpler than that. All we need to do is just simply repeal the Single European Act, which I believe was passed in the 1970s.
Yeah, what I've done is say that I believe, and I mean, it's my belief, I'm not a constitutional expert, that what Parliament ought to do, first of all, is to repeal the 1972 Act. I know there are difficulties about that, but nevertheless, I still believe that that should be considered. But I also believe that the negotiation need not take any more than a few months. And a lot of other people agree with me that we should get on with the job. The people have spoken, long live the people, and let their wishes be carried out, and carried out quickly.
What do you make of the fact that Nigel Farage has given a sort of surprise stand down in UKIP? I realise it's not a major force in Parliament, only having one MP, Douglas Carswell, but again, a sort of vacuum at the top.
Well, again, as an independent Labour peer, I can't really tell you why he resigned, except that I do know that he's been having very serious threats against him and his family. And he has, after all, done 24 years and has reached the point, I think, which he wanted to reach and for which he went into politics, and that is a decision by the people of this country to leave the European Union. And I think we have to respect that. I know him very well. I've spoken on platforms with him. And indeed, a long time ago, I sort of used to be the main speaker, and he was the junior speaker. But, of course, now he's the senior man, and I'm very much junior.
What do you put the swing in the Labour Party away from being, I suppose, a Brexit or towards the European Union over the years? Because I know, certainly back in the 1970s, it was Harold Wilson that actually got the people a vote in the first place. When Ted Heath, the Conservative Prime Minister, took us in to the European Union, there was no vote. He just took us in. And so over the years, people like Tony Benn, for example, was an ex-Bristol MP, was actually against the EU. What do you put the swing towards the EU down to?
Well, of course, Heath didn't have a referendum And in the 1970 election, in his manifesto, he said, "All I want is to negotiate no more and no less." And of course, he broke his promise. And at that time, the Labour Party were fiercely against the EEC, as it then was, the European Economic Community. And the only reason we had a referendum was because of the split in the Labour Party and the leadership of Tony Benn, of course, a Bristol MP at that particular time, to have a referendum of the people. And we had that referendum, and the people, I think, were misled into believing that it was simply a common market, and they voted by 2-1 to remain in. But I have to say to you, because people are talking about the referendum not being close enough, or, you know, we should have another referendum, which is obviously absurd, that the European Communities Act 1972 was passed by only 8 votes. 8 votes to take us into what I knew was going to be a united Europe, if I can put it that way, and eventually a country called Europe. And I've always been against the British membership. I made my first speech against it, as a matter of fact, in 1962 in a place called Bullhampton, near Newbury, when I was fighting that constituency.
Well, you say you knew it was going to become some kind of United States of Europe. How did you know that?
Because I read the Treaty of Rome. It is perfectly clear in the Treaty of Rome that the whole objective was ever closer union, as it still is.
One of the consequences of Brexit has been quite a lot of financial damage here in Britain. M&G and Aviva have suspended property funds following the Brexit vote. Firms said high levels of uncertainty caused by the referendum have led to investors rushing to withdraw their funds. These are big property investment funds, and it looks like they are some of the first to be saying, actually, we think that Brexit is going to be very financially damaging.
Yes, as I said in the House of Lords, oh, ye of little faith, oh, ye of little faith in your country, for heaven's sake, this country has 1,000 years of history. It's led the world in many respects and still does. It is the fifth largest economy in the world. Of course, some of the people are going to be frightened because it's something very new indeed, which a lot of people have had no experience of anything else. But, you know, the referendum was only a fortnight ago. There were bound to be reactions about it, but I think you will find that people will settle down to what has happened. Once they understand the way forward, then they will make... They will make their adjustments in light of the general economic conditions.
Well, yeah, but the Prudential Insurance said they'd seen a marked increase in customers trying to pull out of their property portfolio,
well,
which includes retail and office space after the referendum. Also, Laith Calaf, an analyst at stockbrokers Hargreaves Lansdown here in Bristol, said the dominoes are starting to fall in the UK commercial property market as yet another fund locks its doors on the back of outflows precipitated by the Brexit vote. He says it's probably only a matter of time before we see other funds follow suit.
Well, let's wait and see. Of course, ordinary people have been frightened by the Remain campaign during the Remain side during the campaign. So obviously they've been frightened because the people generally have made a decision that in spite of all the threats that remain, what they want is for Britain to be governed itself by its own institutions and by its own MPs and elected government.
Martin,
and
what do you
a lot of people have set the economic matters aside and says, we want our country back.
Martin,
they agreed with the Brexit campaigners.
Yeah, Martin, why this property, these property funds, why have they had to be closed? Why are people withdrawing their money from there particularly?
Well, there's an issue about, we've got a property bubble in this country, which was going to burst anyway, and this may be the reason why, you know, this is simply the proximate cause of it. I think the real problem with Brexit is within the pigs countries, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, their bonds have been tanking as a result of our vote. And, of course, the real problem is that the banking system is immensely fragile. And what happened in Greece this time last year, when they weren't threatening to leave the European Union, they were actually determined to stay in, but they were threatening to leave the euro, but they didn't carry it through, which is why Varoufakis resigned from the Syriza government.
That referendum was ignored, wasn't it? Really?
It was. Well, and, of course, what Varoufakis was arguing is if you're going to threaten to leave the euro, you've got to be prepared to carry through your threat, and on that basis they will negotiate. But if you threaten to leave the euro and then bottle it, which is what they did, then you end up with a worse austerity deal than you had before.
So is the EU like a Hotel California? You can turn up but you can never leave.
It's the EU is an undemocratic, corporate dominated institution, much like the British state, much like the American state. We don't really have democracy in Britain or in the European Union, and in many ways the economic problems we face with a completely insolvent banking system globally based in the City of London are horrendous. We should have been talking since 2008 about nationalising the banks. I mean, really nationalising them, not just giving them a load of money and telling them to carry on as they were before. We haven't. What we've done is chucked a load of money at it, and that's what's kept the markets relatively stable in the last couple of weeks, as they've switched on the money machine. But of course, in the end, it is going to crash. One of the things about being a Labour activist over many years, not as many as Lord Stoddart, is that we do have an analysis of capitalism. We understand how it works far better than many of the people who claim to represent it. And in actual fact, this system is not sustainable, and it's not sustainable in the European Union. It's not sustainable in Britain. It's not sustainable globally, and the only politician at the senior level who's actually talking about capitalism as an unsustainable system is one Jeremy Corbyn. The rest of them are still stuck in the rut.
There's also a referendum in Italy due in October, which is a kind of constitutional referendum, which is actually possibly going to be like the next chance for a wide number of population in Europe to say no to the European Union. Anyway, Lord Stoddart, what do you make of this, Martin saying there about this so-called property bubble, and this is going to burst at some point anyway?
Well, I'm not at all sure that will happen. And of course, I think we do really have to take account of what's happening in the European Union itself. It really could be on the verge of collapse, and it's better under those circumstances that Britain should be out of it and dealing with its own problems. And Mr. Summers has just said, there is an alternative to what's going on in this country and what sort of country this is, and it's being put forward by Jeremy Corbyn. But unfortunately, the Blairites, and I call them that advisedly, in the Parliamentary Labour Party want to get rid of him because he really wants to give the people of this country a choice.
And one of those Blairites you're just talking about there is the MP for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair, and she was on the radio here on BCFM yesterday morning on the One Love Breakfast, being interviewed by Pat Hart, and she is absolutely adamant that because Bristol voted Remain, we must remain in the European Union.
The main thing I do as a Member of Parliament is represent my constituents.
Yep.
And my constituents voted overwhelmingly to remain in the European Union, and since the referendum they have been emailing me in their thousands, and overwhelmingly what they've been saying to me is they want to remain, they want me to do everything I can to slow the process down or stop it completely. And on day one after the referendum, my leader said that he wanted us to go for an early exit. Now, that's fine, he can say that, but actually Labour policy is to remain. So when he did that was already a problem for me, because A, it contradicted with Labour policy, but B, it contradicted what my constituents were saying, and I have a duty, even if it's difficult, and it was, to stand up for my constituents constituents first and party comes second. So I had to resign from the front bench so that I could come from the back bench, because when you're on the front bench, your duty is one of collective responsibility to stick with the leader's views on everything. So just like Jeremy did from the back benches when he rebelled against the other leaders of the Labour Party over 500 times, I needed to step down so that from the back benches I could represent the needs of my constituents in Bristol.
Okay.
Now, actually, what she's saying there, Lord Stoddart, is constituency first and party second.
But this was a United Kingdom referendum. And in England and Wales, the majority for Brexit was 2 million, not 1.25 million, as opposed to the United Kingdom. And, you know, I have to say that my former constituents in Swindon voted for Brexit. So, you know, if you really want to do things on a constituency basis, then we better break up the United Kingdom into constituencies. It's nonsense. This was a United Kingdom referendum. The people have spoken, and those who wish to set it aside should grow up, quite frankly. I simply cannot understand why, when the people have been given an opportunity and a long time to consider and have a great campaign, who have decided something, but there are others who presume to say that the British people were wrong. I believe in democracy, and in my very many years in politics, I know one thing. Sometimes it's been to my detriment, but the democracy works. And when the people have spoken, they are usually right. And when I was defeated in Swindon in 1983, my last words to them were this: the people have spoken, long live the people. And it's about time people who pretend to be Democrats understand that.
But her main concern, one of them anyway, Thangam's main concerns she expressed on that same programme yesterday morning here on BCFM, was that Jeremy Corbyn effectively is a loser.
If there's a leadership election and Jeremy Corbyn wins, who is there in the Labour Party right now that could take the bull by the horns and turn around and say, listen, let's unite everybody and join with the unions and everyone else, even people that have voted for other parties? And when they look at Labour, they think, do you know what? He's one of the few politicians I trust.
Yeah, now that's... I've got to say, Pat, you know, I talk to voters from across the country.
Yeah.
And that's not connecting with voters in the seats that Labour needs to win. If we ever want a Labour Prime Minister again, we need to be winning in Kingswood, in Gloucester, in the Swindons, in further down the southwest, in Plymouth, in Mid Wales. And that he's not connecting
Is Brexit...
He's not connecting there.
Is Brexit... Was that the right yardstick? Because
yardstick.
From my understanding, I guess, you know, in or outs or whatever, there have been Labour voters that have been disenfranchised for a long time. And bear in mind, Labour lost the last general election.
Yeah.
Bear in mind that when it came to by-elections, Labour have won everything.
In safe
seats.
Mayoral
elections. In
very safe Labour seats. And actually, the margin was far too close in some of them. So, as a leader, I'm still behind him. I'm on the back benches. And I'm going to show him the same respect that he showed to other Labour leaders, which is he rebelled over 500 times.
Okay.
He's a routine rebeller. Now, what I want to see, I want to be clear about what I want to see in any leader of the Labour Party, and at the moment I'm not seeing it, is the ability to connect with voters in Gloucester, in Plymouth, in the Swindons, in Mid Wales, in places in our heartlands, but also in swing seats, where we are losing support. I'm not just losing it at a dribble, we're hemorrhaging it. Not like Bristol. Bristol's an outlier in the southwest. In Plymouth, we've lost so much support. And we're going to have to win those seats back if we ever want a Labour government again. So what I want from the leader of the Labour Party is someone who is willing and able to listen to people with whom he does not agree and to try and persuade them to vote Labour. And at the moment, we haven't got that.
Well, Thangam Debonair there. That was, again, another clip from her appearance on BCFM yesterday morning on the One Love Breakfast show. Lord Stoddart of Swindon, she mentioned Swindon there, and she says that Jeremy Corbyn couldn't win it.
Well, it wasn't won at the last election, and he wasn't the leader. So, you know, that's a prediction which she has no right to make. But I would remind her that the Labour Party has just put on 100,000 new members. What does she say about that? And, you know, I remember, of course, that all these things were being said about Corbyn before the last local elections. That it was going to be a disaster. We were going to lose the Labour Party or the other. Hard to get out of the habit of referring to we, but the fact of the matter is that when it came to the push, the Labour Party did extremely well. Extremely well. And on the by-election, of course, they increased the majority.
This is interesting. When
Corbyn was the leader.
Interesting, isn't it? But we also had, under Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party winning Bristol, with more Bristol councillors taking a majority on Bristol. We had also Labour's mayor removing George Ferguson, the independent mayor, in Bristol, and in Sadiq Khan in London, the Labour Party taking over London. So I'm not quite sure where Thangam's coming from, saying that he's not a winner, he's a loser.
If you're asking me, Tony, well, I think there's a contradiction in what she's saying there. She's saying that because she represents Bristol with its radical Remain constituency, she wants to rebel against Jeremy Corbyn, but she wants to win over people in Kingswood, Gloucester, Swindon, who all voted for Brexit. Now, surely the way to reach out to those people is not to spit on what they've just decided to do and to reconcile ourselves to Brexit. Surely that's the grown-up way to go, and I voted for Remain. But she's saying that she wants to represent Bristol and no doubt to try and stop Brexit from taking place, and we should do everything to stay inside the European Union because what Bristol wants, but we've also got to reach out to marginal constituencies where everybody voted Brexit. Totally incoherent.
Well, there's been quite a few accusations that the the anti-Corbyn coup plotters, if you can call them that, people who've left the shadow cabinet at this crucial time, are career politicians, that they're looking for a, you know, wider career, and Thangam had a pretty robust defence of that.
Most of the politicians I meet, the MPs, I look and I think, are these career politicians? And then if there's a career politician, my trust kind of...
Jeremy is a career politician.
Yeah.
He's done nothing else. Mm. That's his only job. That's all he's ever done. He's never known life outside of actually not just a Westminster bubble, but an Islington bubble and a protest movement bubble. And that connects with a lot of people. I'm not going to deny that. Yeah. Of course it does. But it doesn't connect with enough of the country for us to form a government. I didn't go into politics to be in a protest movement. I could have done that without being elected. I went into politics to try and create a Labour government and a Labour Prime Minister.
But you know, Tony Blair did that.
Well, Kerry McCarthy talked about Jeremy Corbyn as a kind of cult leader, and she's saying there he's leading a kind of protest movement, not a serious political party, Martin.
Well, a lot of this comes down to, I don't know what Lord Stoddart's views are on this, the electoral system in this country allows a few hundred thousand swing voters in marginal seats in mostly in the southeast of England to determine national elections. It means nothing, of course, in Belfast, nothing in Glasgow, nothing in North Wales. But that's where British elections are decided. Perhaps it's about time we all put our thinking caps on and changed the constitutional system under which we live. We might want to reform the House of Lords, we might want to change the electoral system. And in fact, we've already changed the electoral system in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales, because particularly in Northern Ireland, if we hadn't done that, the war would never have ended. And I'm afraid that I see all of our Labour MPs locally as careerists, and I think they've shown that pretty clearly in the last week or so.
Hang on a minute, because what she's just pointed out there, Thangam, is that actually Jeremy is a career politician. He's never done a job outside politics.
What he is an absolutely dedicated principled politician. If you look at his voting record in the Houses of Parliament, for example, he brought an early day motion to condemn Saddam Hussein's gassing of the Kurds at Halabja just after you left Parliament in 1983, Lord Stoddart. And at the time, of course, he didn't get many supporters, but we were supporting Saddam at the time. And then, of course, he then opposed the first Iraq war. That is consistency over time. That's why Bernie Sanders has got the under 25 votes sewn up in the United States of America. They can tell people who are consistent and serious and people who are who go with the wind, and he's not one of them.
Lord Stoddart, what do you make of this accusation that Jeremy Corbyn is a career politician? Because he certainly hasn't ever done a proper job, has he?
I think he did do some teaching, yes. But of course there are many people who are career politicians, but they have a life outside as well. And Corbyn has been active in many fields, and he's done it well. And as far as the Iraq invasion in 2003, I was absolutely on side with him. I knew it was going to be a disaster, and that has now been proved to be the case by the Chilcot inquiry, the result of the Chilcot inquiry. The Iraqis have suffered terrible damage, loss of life, and destruction of their country as a result of what Blair did, and that was to mislead Parliament and go into Iraq on a false prospectus.
Well, one of the things that's been said at Chilcot and around the whole Iraq war, that this was some sort of mistake, that did you believe that, or do you think the whole thing was just a deliberate conning of the public by the press and by the people that wanted the war?
Well, the letter from Blair to Bush sets that right, doesn't it? That he was going to do it, whatever. And whatever Parliament decided, as a matter of fact. We had no right to be there, and it saddens me so that we have caused so much mayhem in that poor country.
One of the things we'll be talking about in the second hour is this whole business. But let's hear now from Channel 4 News, who interviewed John Snow, interviewed Admiral Lord West, who was one of the operational chiefs in the Royal Navy in 2002, in the run-up to the Iraq war, before there'd been any votes or anything.
The year before this started, in 2002, I was the commander-in-chief of the fleet, the operational commander of the fleet. And in July of that year, I know I was told by someone very, very high up that we would be invading Iraq with the Americans. And I had a meeting with my fleet command team, and I said I want the Navy and Marines ready for war in the Northern Gulf, because I had no idea of what the operation was going to be, by the 31st of December this year. That was 2002.
How high does very, very high up get?
It wasn't as the first high as you can get? It wasn't the first Sea Lord. And it wasn't as high as you can get, but it was very high up. That's all I'm willing to say, really.
Right.
And I knew, for example, we would need mine countermeasures vessels, and I said, right, we'll sail them after the summer leave, because they take longer to get there. The excuse we'll use is they're doing exercises. So when in August, late August, the First Sea Lord left, and I went and relieved him, and I then moved into the First Sea Lord, so I was in the corridors of power, I was able to see what was going on, and there were discussions about, you know, would we be going, the army, for example, wanted to order kit and weren't allowed to. I don't think they knew when, but I think the intention was to invade Iraq. I mean, that's certainly my belief. Now, I might be wrong, I don't know, but that was my belief. And interestingly, I received an email today, as a result of the fact I'd said something, from someone who was very involved with getting Storm Shadow. This is a missile bus bunkers carried by tornado aircraft. They weren't ready for it. They were told in September, get this ready, we need it by March. Well, I was never asked by Lord Chilcot to give evidence. So I felt there had been a decision this was going to happen. And then as we got nearer and nearer to the end of the year, then the following year, people were casting around for let's find an excuse for why we should, a better reason. I mean, the reason to me, I thought, when people told me, first of all, in July was, well, Saddam Hussein has been trying to shoot down our aircraft in the no-fly zone. He's actually killing a lot of his own people. You know, he's a danger. I'd been Chief of Defence Intelligence for 3 years, from 1997 to 2000, and I did not believe the issue that there were lots of weapons of mass destruction.
That was Admiral Lord West talking to Channel 4 News' John Snow earlier this week. Martin, this is pretty damning stuff. Effectively, what it's saying is that a decision was made behind closed doors to invade Iraq, and then a whole load of establishment machinations went into effect to try and bamboozle the press, the public and politicians into agreeing to it.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious to all but a child that that's what happened. I think, very interestingly, the former head of the British Armed Forces, who's now, I've been trying to wrap my brain to remember who he was, but he was interviewed on Newsnight, and he said, well, I insisted that Blair come up with a cast iron case for legal case for war. And what I said to him was, you've got to come up with a legal argument for war. And eventually, of course, a flimsy legal argument was constructed. And Paxman then says to him, well, you know, you must have realised that that wasn't a proper legal judgment. He said, yes, but the point was that once we've got a legal judgment, it's him that's going to The Hague and not me. Because I've been given an instruction by the Prime Minister who says it is legal, then I'm off the hook. Now, actually, I think that as head of the British Armed Forces, he should have been braver and said, no, unless you can show me a proper legal reason, we ain't doing it. Just as the police would have to do in similar circumstances. And I'm afraid that the leadership of the British Armed Forces fell down there because they knew it was wrong, they knew it was illegal, but they went along with it anyway, provided they didn't have to carry the can. But, of course, lots of other people have had to carry the can and more.
Certainly many terrible mistakes were made, but also quite a lot of, I would say, war crimes and criminality. Before we hear from Lord Stoddart, let's just hear Prime Minister's question this week, which came up on Wednesday, about whether any lessons had actually really been learned.
On a day when significant questions have been levelled at the collective decision-making of politicians, military leaders and intelligence services, many of our constituents will be seeking reassurance that the lives of their loved ones were not given in vain and that the mistakes made will never happen again. Can I ask the Prime Minister, will he ensure that the lessons learned will be fully examined and acted upon so that there can never be a repeat of the tragic mistakes made over a decade ago?
Yeah. Yeah. Prime Minister. Well, I'm grateful to our honourable friend for his question, and I can certainly give that assurance. We will have, I'm sure, plenty of time this afternoon to discuss the Chilcot report, and Sir John Chilcot is on his feet at the moment explaining what he has found. I think the most important thing we can do is to really learn the lessons for the future, and the lessons he lays out quite clearly. We'll obviously want to spend a lot of time, I'm sure, talking about the decisions on going to war and all the rest of it, but I think the most important thing for all of us is to think, how do we make sure government works better, decisions are arrived at better, legal advice is considered better? All of those things, I think, are perhaps the best legacy we could seek from this whole series, whole thing.
Well, one of the lessons the armed forces have definitely learned, and that is not to trust the intelligence services just on hearsay, to make sure that there's hard evidence before going to war. But Lord Stoddart, what do you make of this, whether you think any lessons have really been learned?
No. And judging by what the Prime Minister has said, they're not going to be learned. And one of the great problems is that Prime Ministers have taken the view that they're presidents, unelected presidents, and it means the cabinet government has been set aside. And what we need to get back to is cabinet government. After all, our whole constitution depends on cabinet government, not on the will and willfulness of prime ministers, but proper cabinet government responsible to the House of Commons in particular. Until we get back to that, we're going to have these mistakes because the matters, high matters, are not being properly considered. Now, I don't want to take you back too far, but when Clement Attlee was the Prime Minister, he believed that he was primus inter pares, as the Prime Minister should be. That is the constitutional position. And he held three cabinet meetings a week. So that, in fact, he was advised and consulted with his colleagues, amongst whom he believed he was just primus inter pares. And until we get back to that, we won't get back to democratic government in this country.
Well, I'm no Latin expert, but I think that means first amongst equals. One of the consequences, not of Iraq, but of the Brexit vote, is the retreat of George Osborne from his austerity programme, at least supposedly, this attempt to balance the books, balance the budget. And this was brought up by Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Jeremy Corbyn!
Mr. Speaker, concerns about the fiscal rule and investment are obviously spreading on his own benches. Yeah. The work and pension secretary and business secretary have seen the light. They now agree with my honourable friend, the Shadow Chancellor, in backing the massive investment programme we've been advocating. Yeah. Isn't it time that he thanked the honourable member for Hayes and Harlington for the education work he's been doing in this House? No. Will he now confirm that the Chancellor's fiscal rule is dead and invest in the North East, in Lincolnshire, in Derbyshire, all those places that feel, with good reason, that they've been left behind and the investment is going to the wrong places and they're ending up with few jobs on low wages and insecure employment to boot?
Prime Minister. If the investment was going in the wrong places, we wouldn't see 2.5 million more people in work, and we wouldn't see a fall in unemployment and a rise in employment in every single region in our country. The only area where I think the Right Honourable Gentleman has made a massive contribution is in recent weeks he's come up with the biggest job creation scheme I've ever seen in my life. Almost everyone on the benches behind him has had an opportunity to serve on the front bench. Old job creation schemes, it's been a bit of a revolving door. They get a job, sometimes for only a few hours, and then they go back to the back benches. But it's a job creation scheme nonetheless, and we should thank him for that.
Well, the usual knockabout stuff from Cameron there, but of course the point is that austerity is over. The idea that you can that you've got to balance the books within a specified timescale is definitely gone, as Danny Blanchflower, who used to work for the Bank of England, pointed out this week, and a good thing too. It's common sense not to try and not to shoot yourself in the head.
Lord Stoddart?
Well, I thought that Jeremy Corbyn's intervention was a good one. Exactly the sort of intervention that a good opposition leader should be making. And all he got was derision, not only from the Conservative benches, but by some of his so-called supporters on the Labour benches as well. And as for George Osborne, his behaviour during the referendum was scandalous. You know that he should be threatening pensioners with reduction in their pensions, doing away with the with their travel, doing away with their television licences, threatening the middle classes whom they're supposed to represent with extra taxation, tuppence in the pound, and an increase in inheritance tax. I mean, if those weren't frightening remarks and decisions, I don't know what were.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. That's our guest, Lord Stoddart of Swindon, who's an independent Labour peer. We'll be back after the news, talking Chilcot.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol.